you, if you miss any of it, or you have to leave early, or you realize later that one of your colleagues definitely needs to hear this, they can come back to the same URL and watch the recording. It does take a couple of hours for it to load up, but it will be there for you. The Global Math Department prides itself on being friendly and supportive, and the chat room is available for topical and general conversation throughout the meeting. If you have questions, you can put them there. You can also put them in the tab at the top of the chat window that you'll notice that says Q&A. That would also be a good place to put your questions. Sometimes Rose will probably catch them in the chat window, but don't worry if she doesn't, because that's my job, is to pay attention and make sure that all of your questions are answered. So our speaker tonight is Rose Zivic. Rose is a former secondary school mathematics and computer science teacher, but currently is a professor of mathematics education at Penn State University. She works with prospective math teachers and thrives on classroom-based research that explores how teachers draw on their knowledge and experience to support their students' learning. You can find Rose on Twitter, and I'll post her Twitter handle there in the chat window. And tonight, she's going to be talking to us about mathematical modeling in school mathematics and how to help students learn to make better choices that matter when modeling. So without further ado, Rose, go ahead and take it away.
Thank you so much, Paula, and thank you all for being here for this conversation. I'd like to approach the topic of mathematical modeling and talk about the idea of choices, unpeel what we mean by the givens and the chosens. But as we're doing this, I'm thinking about the idea that one thing we can see happening in school mathematics is this push to assign full-scale projects. And those can be things that take several days. And I'm thinking that those are good and important. We also need ways to think about bringing modeling into our classroom from pre-kindergarten through grade 12, from small, medium, large size classes and children of different ages, in also our daily lessons. So what I'm hoping we're going to be able to do tonight is to talk about some ways in which we can teach students to be modelers and better modelers. We'll do that with some conversation about what we can do in daily lessons, some ideas, and how those ideas might turn into some actions. As we're talking about this stuff, we're going to see, I hope, that it's consistent with other ideas that come up in conversations about teaching mathematics, when we talk about scaffolding and kind of cognitive demand, questioning, and a number of other things along the way. So with foreground student choice, the notion is that when we want to think about more modeling, one of the things I think we can do is focus on the choices that students are making and realizing the choices that we make and how those affect what students get to do. So the gist of this section is going to be that we'll say a little bit about what we mean by mathematical modeling. We won't spend much time on that. We're going to talk about the idea of opening up a problem, then connect the idea of choice to opening up a problem, and see how choice is ubiquitous in mathematical modeling. We think of modeling as a process. I want to do that through some examples. The examples that I've chosen range from problems that work in the early grades through problems that work with high school and college students. And in this whole process, I'd, of course, love to hear your questions and reactions as we go along. Part of what I'm drawing on, I thought I would say up front, is the Guidelines for Assessment and Instruction in Mathematical Modeling Education. You might be familiar with the GAME report. It is one that comes from a number of people who work professionally in mathematics, in modeling, and talks about what this might look like across the various grade bands that we have and also into teacher education and college. Going to refer to a few things out of that particular report as we go along here. Okay. So why choice? The quote that you see here is not intended to be a definition of modeling, and you might find it kind of curious that in mathematics, a field where a definition means something, it's really difficult to find the definition of modeling. In fact, many places you're going to see people talking about mathematical modeling can be defined in many different ways and has been talked about in different ways. But I think this quote picks up on some of the things that's consistent about it, no matter which definition or which view you happen to take. So there's a notion that modeling is iterative, and involves frequent revisions. That's part of what comes from the idea that modeling involves the messy and the open-ended problems. But the part that I'm really focusing on tonight is this idea about students making choices. Choices about how they're going to approach a problem, how they're going to deal with the real world, how they're going to evaluate their own work. And in particular, thinking about students making some really genuine choices about the problems that they're going to be working with. So let's start with an example. And this example is actually a sequence of problems. And the problems are ones that I hope will illustrate what it means for students to have more or less choice. As we're going through here, I would welcome people to help me out with these things. So I'm starting with this very first problem, 300 divided by 25. I'm hoping that on a good day, 12 is the answer that I come up with. But I want to think about this problem. And so what do you think? When students encounter the problem 300 divided by 25, what are the choices that students could make in working on that problem? They can divide. Estimate. You can multiply, guess, and check. So I think what we're suggesting is that they could use some interesting things that they know about multiplication, such as groups. And in many ways, what they're doing here is thinking about a strategy that they might use to do it. And that strategy could draw on several different things, including the notion of partitive and quotative notions. Many times when they're doing a problem like this, the idea might be for them to practice something they've seen before. And as you can see by the number of ideas that are coming up, there are that many different ways to approach it. And we could have students also thinking about making choices between efficient strategies, strategies that get to an answer in a relatively short period of time, and also the effective ones, ones that get to the right answer and are valid. I think about this one and I say, you know, how does that problem perhaps change as we expect different things of students? If you look very carefully at the 300 divided by 25, it might change into something like this as students become somewhat older and they're asked to solve this problem. So if we think about this, what would be an answer that we would expect students to give to this particular problem? Less than 12. A decimal? About 10? More than 10? So I see us thinking about different ways that students might respond to it. I've seen students come up with an answer that looks something like this decimal form or some other things. And I think about what are the choices that happen in this case. And I think it's safe to say that the choices that students can make in this choice have to do with what strategy they're going to use again. But it also has something to do with what the format is for the answer. And as we can see it's happening here, we have some choices about how it's going to be rounded, about a decimal value, about mixed numerals. Perhaps we could even think about improper fractions and the ways in which it might play out in that sense. So I see that when we use these two kinds of problems, and we're even thinking about the way that we might have students move from thinking about division with whole numbers, division with whole numbers, where the quotient is not necessarily a whole number. We can think about ways that we change the problem and students' choices change to go with it. Have a next problem. And this one is the question stated verbally of what is the quotient of 295 and 25? I suspect that when students look at this problem, they might have the same responses to the last one, 295 divided by 25. But I think there's something that happens here in terms of, in this verbally stated problem, they might also give an answer of something like 0.85 or 25 to 95th. And in this case, there's another kind of knowledge that might be involved here. So when you think about the problem, the word quotient could be implying that the operation would be division. It also is the case that in the problem was stated this way, that the students have this choice of whether it's going to be, or which number rather is going to be the divisor and which one's going to be the dividend. They also have a choice of how they're going to express it in terms of if they're going to use something with a division sign as in the previous example, or if they might do something different in that process. It suggests that when we start adding these things, we can see how it could be that the way that students think about verbal problems can be a little bit more challenging than the straight symbolic forms. But I want to take another one now. And this is a problem that I think looks somewhat like what we might call the word problems, story problems that students encounter. I'm guessing that students would likely come up with an answer of 12 buses for one like this. And so then I ask, in that case, what are the choices the students have to make here? And I would think that in this case, they're going to have a strategy to find the quotient and the format. The operation, it might be that they have typically four that they would think about choosing from. We know from the research in math ed that if there's a number like 325, a larger one, a smaller one like that, they might be encouraged to divide. They also have to think about some way of labeling it, and that might come to, from that question they're asked and from the context. And thinking about that notion, the symbolic form of how they're going to represent the words that they have in numerical form. What happens if we change that, though? And this time we're not talking about 300 students, we're talking about 295 students. You might have seen examples of problems like this that have been around for actually a few decades that talk about the difficulty that students have in answering these. So what might the answer be to our question in this case? So if we think about answering a question that deals with the buses, it seems like it would be an answer that involves an integer, that they still need to work with that whole notion. There's a notion of rounding that comes into play. But with all the things about the format of the answer, the operation, there's also the idea that the answer needs to be meaningful in the context that they're working in. And the difficulty that's documented, students have trouble doing this. That seems to suggest to me that we can try something else here. And think about the other thing that happens with a problem like this is that students actually have to make a choice in thinking between, are they thinking about a linear relationship where it would be simply the number of students divided by the 25, or might it also be the idea that they're thinking about what we would call a step function, where we're going to have answers that run from 11, that would be 11 or 12, not the part in between there. And I'm thinking about that question, and then I'm saying, well, what if we open up this a little bit further and we give this opportunity for students to make more choices about what happens here? And so I'm asking this question. And I'd really like you at this moment to share out some ideas about, in a question like this, what are the choices that students would be making in trying to answer this one? I have a suspicion that many of us have had to work with field trips and the kinds of transportation things that come up with that. And if I notice what's happening here, there are a variety of questions that we start asking. And some of the things that we already talked about in terms of the operations and all that might still be there. But they're talking about the forms of transportation and which ones would they possibly use and include when they report out. They might ask, where are they going? There might be school policies and other things that come into play. And at this moment, we're seeing where there are a lot of choices that are involved. And the choices that are here have a lot to do with how the students perceive what's happening in the real world. I would think that's what we mean when we start opening up a problem and giving students more things about which they can make choices. And so at this point, I'd like to be able to say, by the way, the answer to this question, I suspect it's going to be a lot more difficult to give with a great deal of confidence and immediately that it takes some more work to do this one. And students have an opportunity to do some modeling experiences and hopefully modeling experiences that are applicable to students in the elementary grades and middle school and interestingly in different ways for students in high school perhaps. But now let's take this and say, so what about connecting up the idea of choice, this notion of opening up problems? And this is the part where we think about how it transcends the grade levels and that if you think about just these slight differences in a problem as we move from one to the next, we could think about things that might happen if you take a problem and spend some part of a day on it and not necessarily need to commit a huge amount of time to it. And I think it's also things that happen in sync with the required curriculum as we go along here. So I'm thinking about opening up a problem with this diagram from the game report, where it starts on the left-hand side with a math problem, like the first one started off, ends up on the right-hand side with a modeling problem. And I'd like to actually take the problems that we just saw and lay them out across this diagram, okay, where the first two represent the math problems. I would think that perhaps the third one also represents a math problem. And then we're adding this labeling notion where, in essence, students are probably given the word problem with an intention that they're going to do the 300 divided by 25 and then add on the appropriate label to the result. The application problem with the 295 feels a little bit different in terms of they need to interpret their answer, or sorry, they need to add the meaning to their answer that the number of buses of what the quotient represents has to be in the real world context. And then there's a lot more interpretation of the situation and such that comes with the modeling problem in that last case. So I'm thinking about that as being the idea of opening up a problem and making more choices as we go along. I think that what we find is that many of us can easily find, and in many cases, there are the math problems that are more like maybe the exercises that we find in curriculum, the common things that many of us have done. And I think many of us, as we start thinking about our classroom differently, have moved into some of the other kinds of problems that might be here. And that, to me, gets us into thinking about this notion of mathematical modeling as a process. And I want to think about how choice then fits into math modeling as a process. And if I think about choice, I can be thinking about, are my students really engaged in modeling in different ways? So when I think about math modeling as a process, I know there are many variations on how we can describe this, but across them all, I think these are the common things. The first one has to do with where does it begin and end? That it begins in the real world and it ends in the real world. But specifically, it begins with a real world problem, not with a problem that resides only in math. That it ends with a viable solution and not the one and only exact solution, but a viable one. The second part of it is what has to do with the solution and well, students work on it. That clearly mathematical work is part of the solution, but the other part of the solution is thinking about how you negotiate the real world context. And that the process then has got to be iterative, where you go back and you keep changing and tweaking and improving your answer. And in that case, sometimes what you do isn't going to be so great, and there are going to be those stops and starts. I know that for many of my students, it's been a challenge because they're used to having a problem that they know exactly how to move from the beginning to the end. And in fact, there's that notion that many students have that you're good at math if you can do that and do it rapidly. And that's one of the things that we start challenging when we think about the modeling process. And I know that many times modeling is often conveyed by a diagram. I'm curious, have any of you seen a diagram or use a diagram to describe what modeling is as a process? If you can chat out a yes or no, I would love to hear from you right now. I have found lots of diagrams. Some of them look more impressive than others. Some of them look simpler than others. Some of them pop up more times than others. But I want to use one tonight to talk about this modeling process and then connect it to choice. The one that I chose to use is the one that appears here in the upper right-hand corner. This diagram comes from a book called Getting Started, Getting Solutions. It's a handbook to prompt modeling that comes from the Society of Industrial and Applied Mathematicians. It's a group that is really interested and supportive of high school math, and perhaps some of you have actually have groups that participated. The way in which I like this diagram is that, first of all, at the very top, it starts with a real-world problem. At the very bottom, it recognizes that it ends with a real-world problem and reporting out the results. It acknowledges the notion that a good modeling problem isn't something that just has an answer, but rather is an answer that belongs to some client. There's somebody, including perhaps ourselves, who want to know the answer for a good reason. The other part of modeling diagram that I like about this one is in that upper right-hand corner, the blue rectangle with getting a solution. That part to me represents doing the usual mathematics that students would tend to do in many situations. It would be the division, it would be the graphing of a function, it would be the solving the equations, that part of it. And I like the fact that that's actually a tiny rectangle in this whole diagram. The other part, that huge blue rectangle on the left-hand side with the three red circles, to me is something that brings home why it is that modeling is so useful and interesting to students, and why choice matters so much. That's the part that talks about the kinds of things that students do as they're trying to connect the real-world problem to a mathematical work that they are going to use to solve that problem in some way, or perhaps several mathematical things they're going to use as tools to solve that problem. So in those three red circles at the top, there's the notion of defining the problem. The real-world problem itself is not nicely stated as perhaps mathematics that they can immediately apply, or they might need to do two or three or more different things. So that's a piece that's going to come into play. In the lower right, left-hand side, you have them making assumptions. There are so many times in a problem that there are assumptions that will play out, as we'll see in the examples to come, that students need to address. The red circle on the lower right-hand side is about defining variables. That's more than just saying what X and Y are, and part of what makes the problem rich and meaningful, and also challenges students conceptually to think about what they're doing. When I look over then on the lower right-hand side, the analysis model assessment is the notion that students are given the power and authority to think about their answer and if it makes sense, if it's a good answer, how robust it is. If the real-world problem is interpreted slightly differently, will there be some differences in what comes out of that? I think it helps now to take this diagram and say, what if we were to take the problem set that we just looked at and lay it across this diagram and see where it comes out in terms of choices? So I'm going to start with not the very first problem, but I'll start with the second math problem there. And note that in a problem like this, we talked about the idea that they would make some choices as strategies. I also want to say we could put the idea there that they would choose perhaps the form in which they express the answer. Might be that decimal form, might be an estimation. If we move to the second problem in this list here, the idea of finding the quotient, we're going to see that there's also the idea that they're making choices about the role of the numbers. The work they're doing on those math problems, though, still resides in the upper right-hand corner. Now, what about the next problem? I know, it's on the left-hand side, which probably gives you a good hint that that's an implication that there's going to be activity other than in the getting solutions math part of it. And there is that kind of activity, but here's the thing that strikes me. I confess that there are many times that when a student had a problem like this, and they would ask a question like this, do we have to include chaperones? I'd be somewhat annoyed. What I would recognize now is that that kind of question actually tells me that they're working in defining the problem and thinking about that real world problem and what kinds of things about that scenario they need to know for it to work. So what at one point in time might have been an inconvenient question for a student to ask, I can now embrace as something useful. Likewise, when we move to thinking about the problem with the 295 students, it reminds me that there are choices the students then make when we start moving into applied problems that have to do with how they're going to express their answer. And so now I see some choice activity in another part of this process. Moving on then and thinking about that modeling problem, and here's where we see the choice burst out in this modeling diagram, where obviously the question asks them to choose the best form of transportation, but that means they have to choose what forms of transportation they're even going to talk about. One of us asked, what about a plane? I had a student who asked about a train, some who asked about a skateboard, about a bicycle, about buses, about a metro, so many things you can think about in terms of what matters. And then when reporting out, we can also see they have to choose what forms of transportation to talk about. So in the case of thinking about this field trip, students thought that the reasonable group to report to would be the school principal. And so in that case, you get students who are thinking, well, I'm not going to talk to the principal in our school about a train because that's irrelevant where we are. Another group that said, well, we're certainly going to talk about using the public transportation. That would be a natural thing to do. So that's a sense of how knowing who your client is would affect the choices you make there. And yes, I would think that the minivan with 12 students would make a lot of sense in some cases, maybe more than a bus with 25. But then again, even using the minivan might have to do with what the research travel policy is in the school district. They might want what the travel policy is in the school district, and students might decide they need to research that. That might tell them that, yes, they do have to include the chaperones. They might ask the other obvious question, which I know most students have asked when we thought about it, which is, where are we going? That probably matters a lot in terms of what the best form of transportation is. They also might ask, well, are all the students going? Some students could be absent. Some might not be able to go for other reasons. We need to think about that and think about whether the variable that represents the number of students is also the variable that represents the number of passengers and to distinguish between those two quantities and how they might matter in this particular problem. And then, of course, as someone mentioned earlier, a really key thing about the modeling process here is thinking about what best means. So by looking at this one problem, I think what we see is that choice is run throughout the modeling process, and the choices that we see happening are the very things that make the modeling process both interesting and messy as students work through this entire process. And I'd like to think about another example, and I hope that example shows that there are some things that we do as we move from a math problem into something that's more, not just a word problem, but an applied problem, and then how we can take an applied problem and release a little bit of space so that students have some choices to make about how they're going to use the real world to think about a modeling context that would be appropriate in early and middle grades. But I also like to talk about a problem that has to do with ladders. I think about where I see problems with ladders in the school curriculum. And one of the places where I see it is with a trig problem. I was once convinced that every trig teacher must have a ladder leaning against the side of their house and probably had a flagpole in the front yard. As I read a problem like this, I'm recognizing that students are likely encountering this problem after they've seen the ratios that have to deal with trig functions. There's a notion of, well, I have an angle measure, I have a length, I'm going to use one of those ratios, I'm going to set it up, and I'm going to be able to find out what that distance from the house to the base of the ladder is. I'm going to round it to the hundredth of a foot, and when I look at all that, it strikes me that even if it's intended as an application problem, it's also somewhat close to a word problem where so many of the choices have been taken away. Students know that the answer is going to be in a foot. They know they're going to round to the nearest hundredth. And yes, there are also some implicit choices that have been made here or that are assumed that students will be making here, like there really is a right triangle formed. But I think about that problem, and then I think about the problems that it has to do with earlier on. So I go back to middle school, and I recognize that students might be asked a problem like this. They might apply the Pythagorean theorem. So look at this. They might recognize 6, 8, 10 as the Pythagorean triple. They might also have the problem that comes in a form that looks like this, where the ladder is leaning against the wall. We know how far it is above the ground on one end, and the answer is how far the bottom of the ladder from the house on the other side. When I think about these problems, the one on the left to me strikes me as a math problem. The one on the right strikes me as a word problem, particularly if it shows up as having the triangle there. And I don't want to get so wrapped up in making the distinctions among the math problem, the word problem, and the application problem, as I do about noticing that these problems essentially ask students to take, as they're presented, a piece of mathematics and apply it immediately to come up with a solution. I now want to choose a geometry problem. I'm thinking about geometry, and in geometry, there typically is talks about triangles. And that's true in many high school geometry settings, in some strand of the high school math that's around geometry and triangles. And here's a problem that comes directly out of a high school scenario. I'm going to ask you, if you would, to take a few seconds, read this problem, and as you read it, please chat out the questions that come to mind. Just chat them out. So we're asking about the second window. Where's the ladder positioned? How much higher is the second window? Where are the numbers? Oh my goodness, yes. Than that poor 10-foot ladder. Goodness. Ah, yeah. You can map out some things here, thinking about a right angle being involved. Is there anybody who's done a lot of work with ladders? I know that I grew up with a father who did a lot of work around the house. And if I ever put a ladder up the way this ladder is positioned here, oh my goodness. Oh, yes. I can't stand in the top rung. I also am kind of worried about this ladder. Did you notice the top of the ladder is against the glass? Oh, my, yeah, break the window. Oh, my gosh. I'm a little worried about this situation. I'm noting, though, that this problem was actually an example of applying the hypotenuse leg theorem. If I stop for a minute and think about that, the intent was to think about the window that is on the far right of that side, this other window with a double pane, and thinking about, yes, the ladder would be positioned similarly to reach that window. The intention was to come up with an application problem, but I think here we have a great opportunity to think about a modeling problem and think about how some of the questions come up that we could possibly consider here. These are questions that I had from a number of students and others who looked at this question. And the first one was, I don't know what reaches the window means. Looks like it's against the glass. Somebody asked in the group about how tall is Ashton? Somebody Elsa asked, "Oh, how long is her arms? What does that mean about where you put the ladder? And how far from the top of the ladder can you safely stand? We noticed you can't be on the top rung. The idea of a safe steepness. And the ladder can be too flat to be useful. It also can be too steep for someone to climb safely." Someone else asked, "What do you mean by the second window?" It matters if the second window is the top pane in the window where the ladder is, or if it happens to be that little window in the middle of what looks like the second floor there. And it truly makes a difference if it's one of the windows on the bottom floor there. And then someone else said, "Wait a second. How actually high is one floor of a house? Can that 10-foot ladder be tall enough to reach it? Does the ladder extend?" So at this point, we have some thoughts about the different kinds of questions that students might ask, and that takes us into the different kinds of choices they might make. So in terms of thinking about what are the choices, I can think about the choices when it comes to reaching the first window. If it's against the glass, it seems like we need to lower the top of it, or we might move the ladder off to the side of the window. And Ashton might reach to his left or right to wash that window. If we think about how long his arms are, how are we going to ask that question? You know, obviously, if Ashton was a person in front of us, we can measure it. We could perhaps gather data from several people and use some of the math and statistics we know to come up with an answer. We could check some websites to see the average length of an arm. We might just do an estimate. We also could ask, so how far from the top of the ladder can safely stand? If it can't be the top rung, can it be the second one? We could check some websites. We could call hardware stores, what someone suggested. And we could try it. I'm a little worried about that try it thing, about how that works in class. We did not go there. We're also thinking about the safe steepness of a ladder. We could check some websites. Someone also suggested they could call a local contractor. Surely that's something they must need to know about. The question, what do you mean by the second window? It does matter. And then the question is, wait a minute, if this person's supposed to be washing the windows in the house, shouldn't we think about all of the windows, not just one second window? And then if the ladder is long enough and doesn't look like it is, we might actually need to get a different ladder. If I think about the number of different choices there, where in just a very rough way, I think there are two for the first one, there are three for the second one, three for the third one, two for the fourth one, three for the next one, and at least one or two for the last one. We're already up to hundreds of different combinations of things. That, to me, is part of what makes the modeling problem messy but interesting. And I can see how I could, though, at least take one of these options and see how it plays out when I'm asking a typical question like that in my class. I'm also recognizing that we might want to say what the real-world question is. I think it's probably where should I place the ladder as opposed to exactly where it should be for a second window. And that eventually a right question might be, is this the right ladder to use? Questions like this and this kind of thinking, I would suggest are appropriate for college readiness, career readiness. It's also part of just life readiness. And that's one of the appealing things to me about students making choices as they think about modeling. I can also take that particular problem and see where it fits in this diagram in terms of hitting the glass and how far can the does the ladder extend, or part of understanding the real-world context. I could ask, how am I going to make assumption about what the second window would be? I could think about the safe slant of the ladder, or whether where I should stand the ladder. It's being part of what they might do in terms of researching and brainstorming about it. And there's this thing about arm length, but I think this is interesting because this is where it gets very clear that modeling is not a straightforward beginning-to-end project, and that there were different choices lead to different things. So I would say that arm length is kind of a research thing if we check a website, but there might be different kinds of math involved as part of it if we're going to gather the data or do some estimates. That's also why there's that messiness, but also the engagement and some of kids' natural curiosity about things that are good. I could think of another example. That in a very quick term, what's the kind of problem we frequently do? It's one that has two different pricing plans. This one came directly out of teacher support material for curriculum, where we have two golf courses, and please bear with me, I at least my students, golf courses were not the first thing they wanted to think about. But we can work with the idea of the type of problem as having two pricing plans. Here it's 20 for clubs, 55 per hour. The other is 35 for clubs, 45 per hour. And the question is, when would they be the same? I'm thinking, let's look at the diagram in that assumptions piece. I can actually ask kids about what things they see being assumed here. And I noticed that we're really expecting students to make assumptions even when they ask the question the same way. And I could choose one of these assumptions and follow up on it. So for example, what happens if on a different day of the week that the charge is different, the cart rental is free, you can get two sets of clubs. There are ways in which I can then take those and follow them up mathematically that have to do some of this. And I really want to see the two guys, by the way, Beth, who are working on that ladder. I think about the research opportunities and how we can have the students make the problem their own and create some different ones. I'm also recognizing that these are things I can take a type of problem I see every day and recognize that I need to ask what assumptions are being made. It's part of helping students become modelers as opposed to engaging in a full task, and recognizing that even the question we ask of when will be the same, the better question might be, which plan is better for us? And notice it's even different than the questions we typically ask when we're using that kind of question to solve a system of linear equations or to look at the system's linear inequalities. Just opportunities to open up problems and have students think about some choices they can make. I think choices also work well with full modeling problems. This one particular is the beginning of a modeling problem called Waste Not, Want Not that comes from Moody's Mega Math Challenge. Anybody up there know this? Familiar with Moody's Challenge? It's a set of problems where there's one every year, has a team competition at the high school level. I realized that as I'm thinking about working with younger children, it's probably not the kind of problem I would start with, but it's kind of the notion of where it might go as time goes on. This particular one, I apologize for the fact it's US-centric. It happened to be very appropriate for me to use with a group of students when we were thinking about sustainability as being a major theme of what was happening in the school. And I look at it and say, it gives me some background about plastics, about the kinds of things that might happen, about what the issue is around recycling, and then states the problem about create a model for the amount of plastic that ends up in landfills and to predict the production rates of plastic waste over time and the amount that would be in landfills 10 years from now. The solutions that teams put forward to this problem, if I'm honest about it, they're going to be 5, 10, 15, 20 pages long. It's clearly a real, huge, engaging problem for students. This is an excerpt from one team, team number 1356, and their results. I'm looking at this not to assess the goodness of the assumptions they made, but the assumptions that they made tell me some things about their choices and about how choice is different and important in modeling. So the first one here is that they're choosing to say the city's population is evenly distributed, approximately. The second one is saying that the shape is basically a square. The third one is to say that roads are laid out in a grid plan. I see those three things as ways in which they're making choices to simplify the mathematics to something with which they can work. The last one reminds me that in 2 and 3, they mentioned the three sample cities that were included with data in the statement of the problem, the first part of which you saw on the previous slide. The second excerpt here, one of the things that they talked about was a drop-off center. And I'm recognizing that when students make decisions and they involve choices in a full-fledged modeling project, they can decide such things as not only what resources, like the R.W. Beck Company, are they going to consider, but they make decisions such as in this case, they're going to go for the most cost-efficient type of drop-off center. They check out in some research online about what the best kind of dumpster is to use. They make choices about the cost-efficient aspect of it, and then they make choices about the numbers they're engaged. I think it's interesting that they choose to use the cost of a dumpster is about $5,575 per year. They might have chosen to go with $6,000, $5,600, but they do use that number. It's one of the choices that they make. Moving down here to sensitivity analysis, I wanted to mention this because that's one of the ways in which modeling as a full process can be extremely more interesting. And if you ever wonder why we do the little parameter explorations and all, this is a great way in which they come into play. In this case, they're going to go back and change with population in an area they use, saying, well, what if it's 2% more or less, 5% more or less, 10% more or less? So when they're thinking about how they're going to test their model, they make choices about how they're going to test it, in this case, what percentages they're going to use and what might be important to consider in that direction. They also make choices about how they're going to test the reality of it. In this case, they chose to use only one of the cities, and I'm dying to know why they chose Fargo, North Dakota. That seemed to be the one that they used in that case. So in this particular example from their much longer solution, I'm seeing that where there are choices being made that vary in terms of what the choice is about and how it plays out in the modeling process. So some of the choices are done to simplify the amount of the nature of mathematics. That essentially suggests to me it simplifies how they're going to work in that upper left-hand corner, right-hand corner of the diagram. There are choices they make about how they're going to use or not use some of the given information. Consider some of the examples they're given, but not others, for instance. What they're going to do to use or define some new information. Going out and finding information on cost-efficient sites and what kind of equipment they might use. They could also make the choices about where they're going to achieve a certain goal. So they might be making the assumption that the way they need to report out for their particular constituency is to report out based on the idea of cost efficiency. They also made choices in this case about looking at the parameter and particular percentages in this case as they tested the model. Even in a full-blown project, and perhaps even more so, you have choices all over the place. So I would say that by helping students to make choices in small ways and large ways, we're helping students develop an aspect of modeling that's probably much different than focusing on having them, for example, learn particular mathematics that could be helpful for them in doing modeling tasks. So I'm coming in summary and saying one of the things that is really important to me is that when we talk about modeling in school mathematics, we recognize the value and what can be accomplished with full-scale projects like the recycling project we just considered, but also that all of us on an everyday basis are doing things to help to build up students' repertoire of strategies, the ideas they have, the way they think about things, how they think about assumptions, and in general, how they make choices that will help them become better modelers. Part of the action we can take then is to make those choices explicit in what we do in a daily sense. It works for me to think about it as doing one problem a day, one problem in every set of perhaps topic area we might be in, and that we can do that by taking a common problem and opening it up so that we're not teaching students how to solve a template set of problems, but rather to have that sense of how we might be able to work in a broader sense. And then all that to me is about encouraging and supporting student choice is consistent, I think, with many of the good teaching practices that we have. Okay. And with that, I would say thank you for listening. And I'm open to questions, comments, curiosities, and of course, the ideas that you might have to do. So Frank is asking, do I see this work at the middle school level? actually see it working really well at the middle school level. There have been times when we've looked at some of the problems that students have encountered at the middle school level, and I'm thinking about cases where they start thinking about linear relationships and taking a problem where there's a linear relationship and asking them to think about how it might be modeled in that sense. So rather than giving them the models that they might have to use, ask them to create one to work with. Well, what if you assume that it's valued a little bit differently? You can have it think about the notion of how they come up with what the values might be. So rather than taking it as a given that things have to even be linear, I think that helps. And so the whole notion of fractional computation, I think there's a wonderful piece there that asks questions about, so why are we doing those things? Chris, and I'd love to know the kind of examples you come up with. I hope you'll share them. So Frank is asking about a cache of problems that might be worth exploring. Mm-hmm. I would love to be able to tell you that here's exactly the best place to go right now for a set of problems. But what I can say, Frank, is that there's a collaboration among the SIAM, the Society for Applied Mathematics, COMAP, and the National Council of Teachers Mathematics, NCTM, in the U.S. and Canada, to create a community space. And that space would have both a spot where there will be problems shared and where there can be conversations around those. And I do think what you're saying, Kristen, too, makes sense in terms of it's the notion of the reason that goes behind it and why are we going to learn this? And realizing that when students tell us the problem seems stupid, that we probably should use that as an opportunity to say, yeah, it might be kind of silly. Now, let's see the opportunity to remove the numbers from a problem or remove the question from a problem and ask a more general question. Tape diagrams. Geraldine, I would love if you'd share more about how you're seeing the tape diagrams being used in this case. And there's a lovely example of a friend of mine who was working actually with a group of first graders. And the question came up of what should we bring for lunch? That launched into a wonderful example of how students could engage in some modeling and some mathematics as they thought about such questions as, how many carrots should I bring? And I think there's opportunities to capitalize on what students find interesting and have us make up problems and tasks that are not necessarily about practicing what they know, but about asking a good question where they can use what they know. I'll also share some references here, some of the things to which I referred, if they're helpful. So I think Frank is on to a good resource. Paula's comment about the different types of ladders and how much do they cost? What are some different types? Are they expandable or not? How far can they expand? When people talk about a ladder or a step ladder versus an expandable ladder, there are some differences in those cases. The material from which a ladder should be made. Thank you for your thoughts, your input. I'd love to hear about the ideas that you're using with your students.
So I'm going to do a quick interjection. I just want to say thank you, Rose, for sharing all of that. That was really good, and my brain is in total thinking mode right now, which is good. For all of you that are still with us, I want to encourage you to next week join us again, same time, and we'll be talking about convergent or divergent problem solving. We are here every week, although we do take a sabbatical during summer, but we have a few more weeks left. So definitely join us back. There's always great wisdom from the presenters and great ideas from those people who are participating. We have a couple more minutes before I will officially turn off the recording. So if you want to ask more questions, please feel free in the chat window. They do get recorded as part of the presentation so that when people come back later, they will have some context for what was happening in the conversation. And Geraldine, yes, all the webinars are actually archived in BigMarker, so you can go back and look at them. Which I would strongly encourage because there's lots of amazing ones, just like the one tonight. So does anyone have any more pressing questions that they would like to ask Rose? I know probably, I feel like we're all in this think mode about, ooh, how I want to redo asking problem-solving type questions in my classroom.
Thank you so much, Paula, for your help and willingness.
You're very welcome. This was really great stuff. As a matter of fact, I was talking with someone yesterday about the whole idea of modeling in mathematics. So this gives me lots of, this was well-timed for me, so I greatly appreciate it.
Glad to hear that. I always find it challenging to talk about modeling because to actually do a modeling problem seems so important, but it's so difficult to do in just an hour.
It's interesting what I was thinking while you were presenting about it, just that I feel like lots of times teachers, you know, say, oh, I don't have time, and yet what comes out of it is so much richer than just doing the repetitive problems that often don't stick anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, in my head, there were little synapses going, wow, this would be so much richer and stick with the kids when they do all of these types of things.
I'm also very much aware that it's motivational, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's breaking, you know, the cycle of what teachers are used to doing, for sure, in their classrooms.
Mm-hmm. And really scary at first, I know, for me.
Yeah, well, you know, I loved that you threw in, you know, about the kids asking about the chaperones on the bus. And I thought, yeah, I wonder how many times I was like, really? Does it say anything about chaperones?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On the other hand, do you really want 200 and some kids going on a field trip without chaperones?
That's true. And then I thought, you know what? Those poor kids, like, I shot them down, and they were actually thinking outside the box. I should have allowed that and embraced that. I feel bad now.
Don't feel too badly.
I'm sure a number of us have done it.
Oh, yeah. I hope so, because I would not want to be alone.
Thank you for affirming me. Okay, so I am going to stop the recording officially, and...